It's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning to you. You're very welcome along to the 9 to noon show on this Friday. It's the 9th of August and it's just approaching 4 minutes past nine. And it is our usual Friday show. We've That's Entertainment coming up after 11 o'clock where we will launch our Irish Music Month search for our local hero. We also have that surprise at 10:30 with Sean and the crew. But before all of that, we have our Friday panel where we discuss some of the bigger stories of the day and the week. And we'll just get straight into it and introduce our panel. Delighted to welcome back onto the show Cathy Donoghue, an Inishowen-based journalist and author. Cathy, good morning to you.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
It's great to see you again. Thank you so much for joining us. Councillor Declan Meehan, an independent councillor in the Milford area. Good morning, Declan.
Good morning.
And Antoinette Cunningham, the former General Secretary of the Association of Garda Sergeants and Inspectors. Good morning, Antoinette.
Good morning, Greg.
Just a quickie, I suppose, from you, Antoinette, given your former role. I note this morning that Drew Harris is declining to stay on in his position. I think he did already take a two-year extension. He's not taking any further extension. Surprised at that? Disappointed? Any views?
Yeah, not surprised, really. The commissioner's term was due to end in 2025, so I suppose it's timely now that the announcement would be made that he's not seeking to extend his contract. I think this is going to pose a big challenge for government, Greg. We struggled recently to fill a deputy commissioner's position. In fact, it had to be advertised for the second time recently. It'll be interesting now to see how many applicants and will they fill the deputy position. So if they struggle to fill the deputy, I think it's going to be very challenging for the government to fill the Garda commissioner's position. A difficult task ahead for government, I would say.
And would they be favouring or mind whether it was an internal candidate, so to speak, or look outside the country once again?
Well, you know, public opinion was very strong the last time around that they felt it should be an external person and, you know, that the An Garda Síochána needed a set of external eyes, and Commissioner Drew Harris was ultimately appointed into the role. He'll have served, I think it's almost 5 years now by the time next year comes around. So I'm not sure really where they're going to go with this. I think this is going to be very challenging, and I think it will be widely advertised, of course, but I think it's going to be a very challenging position to fill now.
And is that because it might be seen as a poison chalice, or?
I'm not sure. I mean, An Garda Síochána is still, when you do public attitude surveys in relation to An Garda Síochána, they still come in quite high. Satisfaction ratings are quite high. I suppose the guards, the last few years in particular, Greg, have been very challenging. You know, we haven't seen an increase in Garda numbers. We've seen policing challenges like never before. With the type of crime and disorder and, you know, all of that stuff that's now going on. You know, there's challenges facing policing now that we've never seen before. There is, of course, a reform agenda attached to An Garda Síochána. And when Commissioner Harris came into his role, it was to drive forward the reform agenda, a police service for the future. There's lots of people who would say that that model really isn't providing the service that An Garda Síochána needs to provide. But look, with reduced numbers, you're never going to be able to do everything you need to do anyway as commissioner, you know.
And Declan, in the Milford area, the Donegal area, sort of we feel those winds have changed, don't we, with concerns over the future of, a 24/7 station in Milford, the policing model that, you know, is in place. You do hear from people that you just don't see guards around the place as much as you did at the moment. And then we've got this sort of centralised call answering system. I don't think it would happen, but there's probably a lot of people that would like to see a new commissioner roll some of that back. I don't know what your view on that is.
Yeah, look, as Antoinette said, there's serious challenges being faced by An Garda Síochána, and that's a mixture of government policy, but also internal governance within An Garda Síochána and the allocation of very limited resources available to them. Rural policing in particular has taken a huge hit, not just under Commissioner Drew Harris, but, you know, over the past few commissioners, over the past few governments, and unfortunately rural communities are taking the hit on a lot of that. No more so than in the Milford Garda District. It would be great to see a new commissioner come in. It's also, I suppose, worth remembering that the vast majority of rank and file Gardaí expressed no confidence in Garda Commissioner Drew Harris not that long ago. So maybe it's a positive step in the right direction for An Garda Síochána It's an incredibly important resource. Policing in general obviously is. It's an important service for communities the length and breadth of the country, whether they're rural or urban. And so, you know, I think a lot of people might welcome this news that Drew Harris is not going to seek to extend his contract for another 2-year period.
Yeah, and Cathy, you know, I think 5 years ago, if one of my sons had come to me and said, I'm going to be a guard, Dad, I'd have gone, yeah, okay, that sounds good. But I think if they approached me now and said it, I would try and discourage them. That being said, I take on board what Antoinette says. The majority of people have faith in the Gardaí, but I know we're talking about the top job, but even just entering the force as a whole, the way it's set up, the way it's going, and some of the work that has to be done. I don't know, Cathy, would you recommend someone close to you to join the force?
I'm not sure. I think it's a really tough job, Greg, and I think it's getting tougher. You know, some of the scenes that we're seeing, you know, on our screens at the minute, you know, and Gardaí are at the front line of that. I think they do an incredible job. I also think that there probably is a morale issue at this stage. Maybe a new brim will bring that sweeping change that we probably need in the Gardaí Síochána Síochána. But, you know, I also think that morale is really, really important, and that, you know, we're asking our men and women in the Gardaí to do a really difficult job, but there has to be a visibility there as well. And I think that that is something that's lacking in rural communities, you know, and that relationship comes with visibility. If you have that relationship with your local guard and you can see them, you know, in times of old, we did see our Gardaí, you know, we did see them walking down the streets of our towns and villages. And that's not the fault of the guards. It's a resourcing issue. But I think if people, the community has that relationship with their Gardaí, it builds that confidence and it gives that sort of morale to the force who are on the ground doing the job. So I think that there's a big job of work to be done, and perhaps a new brim and a new man or woman at the top of the force will bring that sweeping change that we really, really need. And most of all, for our communities and for the men and women doing this really important job as well.
Yeah, some of the most challenging postings for Gardaí recently in this country have been sort of anti-immigration accommodation protests down the country. This week, beyond Ireland, we've seen a series of anti-immigration protests across England and in Belfast. They began after three young girls were killed in a multiple stabbing at a Taylor Swift-inspired dance class in Southport. Now, before the suspect's identity was confirmed, false claims proliferated online that he was a Muslim asylum seeker who had just arrived in the UK by boat. In Belfast, homes and businesses of immigrants were targeted. Tough policing may have quelled the violence, but I just wonder what can be done to deal with the core issues here, Antoinette, because it is still, obviously, and a lot of these sentiments and feelings are bubbling under the surface, and it takes an event. We saw it in Dublin, we've seen it in Southport, and how that can be how that can spread very, very quickly. Do you have a view on what we can be or should be doing to sort of address the issues that trigger all of this, I wonder?
I think, Greg, one of the critical things here is around social media, because, of course, after those three young girls were attacked, and the Lord have mercy on them, false and misleading information was spread on social media. And this is a lot of where all of this disorder is now generating from, is disinformation and misinformation spread throughout social media and focusing on particular groups of people, and then inciting hatred and inciting people to go and commit acts of thuggery, violence, rioting, looting, burning buildings, burning cars, attacking police. So, I mean, social media partners have a huge responsibility here. And, you know, when you're operating a social media company in a country, you have to have a license to do that. And this is where government really need to step into the space and say, if misinformation or disinformation is being spread through social media channels, then we have a responsibility here as a government to put systems in place where we can say that post needs to be urgently removed, that post needs to be taken down, you need to be fined, you need to be penalised if you're going to allow that stuff. So that's one of the things, I think, Greg, is social media partners. Look, I think communication too with community groups is absolutely central here. Even in Ireland, where some of the protests have taken place and they haven't resorted to the levels of violence we've seen in the UK, Belfast and in Dublin recently, the overriding message all the time has been a lack of communication, a lack of communication with people living in communities about what's happening in their own place. So communication is key to everything, Greg. So I think social media partners and definitely communication, working with community groups to see what is actually happening, to air their concerns, to take on board what they say, and to assess the suitability of where people are going to be placed if they're seeking emergency accommodation in this country.
Yeah, but the elephant in the room is that the owner, outright owner of the biggest social media news platform in the world, subscribes to a lot of the views and opinions that are posted. He amplifies them, in fact, rather than actively trying to remove them. So I'm not really sure what our government internally can do. I don't even think they know Telegram exists, where an awful lot of this stuff happens as well. So is there nothing we can be doing outside of that online space to sort of address people's concerns or try and get some sort of harmony or understanding or mutual respect in place? Or am I just being too optimistic there?
No, I don't think you are, Greg. I think communication with communities is the key, because the misinformation and the disinformation is being spread online. So you need government policies around migration. Everybody needs to be clear about what they are. But most of all, they need to be communicated down to people at a level they can actually understand. Because people form views and opinions based on bias, based on things that they hear, usually things that are not correct. And when they're more informed, they can make more informed decisions themselves. Mm. Of course, Greg, we also too need to restore law and order. And that's key. When law and order breaks down, you need to restore it as quickly as possible. So within that, then you have to have adequate resources and appropriate police response. And you have to have a swift and efficient court system. And one of the things that we've seen in the UK over the last few days is people who were involved in riots a week ago were sentenced to prison sentences this week. They had their sentencing expedited so that they faced a swift, fast and a severe sentence in some cases, 32 months in prison for one man who was involved in a riot just 1 week ago. That sends out a very clear message from the UK. This will not be tolerated over here. And if you do this, you will be dealt with through the court system swiftly and efficiently. So we need to look at that model here as well.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you quite specifically, because to be honest with you, like, I'm not into sort of authoritarian situations or what have you, but you do, when you do see the Gardaí at some of these events, and I'm on about the violence here, you know, where people are being burned out, bottles thrown, all that. I'm not about people having legitimate protests. Our Gardaí look toothless, and it can be quite embarrassing actually to watch on, not for them because they have to operate within the boundaries that they do, but they literally just have to stand there and take it.
I know, Greg, but you're in a no-win situation at times. Like, you're damned if your response is overzealous and seen to be too swift and too severe. Then you're criticised as well if you take an approach. But on Garda Síochána Síochána, and Commissioner Harris in particular, is very, very strong that the Garda Síochána Síochána model of community policing will always go on a graduated response. So it is not the most severe response in the first instance. It's communication. There will be people will be warned, asked to stand back. So all of those scenes that you see have an unseen commander that will escalate the response as it's required. But Ireland does not want to project an image where our police are standing out front in full battle gear, right helmets, and that if we can provide a response through other means, first of all.
Yeah. Obviously, it's an I get where you're coming from, Antoinette. I want to bring others into, but I mean, I've seen videos of Gardaí standing beside a burning building with people standing in front of them, videoing it, saying, "We told you this was what would happen, you know, right under your nose," and all this kind of stuff. But listen, I take your point then, as I say, I'm not saying we should do what England does, but particularly for the very violent stuff, we just seem to be a little bit toothless. But I accept your point about the how things can progress upwards dependent on the seriousness of a situation. Mm. Declan, your views generally, but also I suppose we must remember, should we, that there's many areas of these country of this country, rural, you know, somewhat urban and very urban, where people do coexist quite happily, and it's that situation being disrupted that would be of a concern to me, but it is there, obviously.
Yeah, I think that, look, and I've spoken about this before, right? I think that, you know, riots are kind of at the extreme end of the spectrum. And what we have, by and large, is immigrants, refugees, living in communities the length and breadth of the country, happily and peacefully and coexisting alongside with people who've lived in Ireland all their lives or your Europeans or British people who've lived here for a very long time. And that is a model that, you know, is working. And, you know, there's a lot of positivity there. There's a very, very vocal minority who I believe the media amplify the voices of. I think that absolutely social media has a critical part to play in spreading disinformation.
Would you argue that that was reflected in the local elections?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, there was a huge, huge, huge concern that there was going to be, you know, quite a significant uptake in or an increase in votes for far right and far right aligned candidates and parties. And there was an increase in that, but there's very few who made it over the line. And I think that we have to look at the 2024 elections elsewhere across the world that have happened, you know, to date, and compare that with our own and see that, you know, that that, I suppose, political representation is not there. So these people are not as numerous as, you know, sometimes we are led to believe. That's not to say that people don't have concerns. It's not to say that some people don't have negative opinions towards them. And I think that a key issue here is communication by the government at every level. And we have seen since this, I suppose, migration sort of migration situation has ramped up since 2022, we have seen a real vacuum of communication from government at every levels. I work in the community. You know, my day job, in addition out of being a county councillor, is and has been as a community worker. And Milford hosts, you know, almost 200 refugees as a town in and of itself. The Milford electoral area is somewhere closer to 650. I can say that we have never, as a community organisation on the ground, working with refugees, working with immigrants, we have never received direct communication from government. And that is ridiculous. That is startling. As the people who are, I suppose, left to deal with initiatives such as integration, but also simply just getting people sorted out with school places and all that, the amount of work that has been done over the past few years, we've not been given an additional penny in funding, and we haven't had any direct communication.
And let's not forget, there was an announcement of a fund by Leo Varadkar some time ago. I think it was circa 20 million that was to be spent in areas that have had to do the most. You know, to extra resources.
Yeah, community recognition fund.
But nothing ever came of that, as far as I'm aware.
Well, to be fair now, that 2023 Community Recognition Fund was allocated, and there are projects that have been funded around the county under the Community Recognition Fund.
I thought it was
fund.
To actually improve, to help, you know, support services. There was talk of extra nurses going into GPs' practices.
Oh, yeah. That's a separate one. And no, there has been nothing on that. I mean, okay. there's been no word of that. There's been nothing tangible that anyone can point to. That can show that there's additional investment to meet the increase in population.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Sorry about I should remember the names of all of these funds. It's hard to keep track. Cathy Donoghue, I beg your pardon, Inishowen-based journalist and author. Your views, please.
I thought it was telling recently, Greg, that Michael Healy-Ray stood up in the Dáil and he was absolutely apoplectic and he held his mobile phone in his hand and he called it, you know, the amount of hate that can be, you know, this is like a, you know, a divisive hate. And he was obviously very, very angry because something had arisen in his own personal circumstances where he felt attacked and vile abuse. And we've seen this when Eamon Ryan retired. We've seen it across the board. We've seen it with the new mayor in Derry. We have seen it, Rashida Adelek. We have seen so much hate online. And I think hate is like the starting point for all of what we're seeing. It's like the manifestation, and almost when the Gardaí stand, you know, at the barricades and the, you know, something is burning, it's actually at that point, it's escalated so far that we're into, you know, it's an emergency situation. I think we need to go back to where so much of this is beginning and trace the hate back to its origins, you know, and that is, you know, there is a coarsening of debate in society across the board in political discourse. But I do think that a lot of the disinformation and misinformation that has been allowed to disseminate publicly online is a really, really big force here. And we have to begin to where, you know, these things generate. and they're germinating. So much of it is online. And I feel like, you know, this, you know, we saw it in Belfast at the weekend, this new twist in the culture wars, this moronic marriage of convenience, you know, and our, the Irish tricolour.
And also, too, in relation to that, Cathy, you do have to question people's sense in that, you know, we've got nurses and doctors having their cars damaged and bricks thrown through their windows whilst they're on shift in the local hospital. And it is a it's a fact. It's not a pro this, that, and the other, that if we lost that, if we lost those staff, both in the North and in the Republic, our health service would actually quite literally collapse.
Yeah, you're right, Greg, but not enough. I don't believe enough has been made of that. What about, you know, a government campaign? You know, and Declan, you're working in the communities, you see people of all faiths and colours coming together to work collectively. We haven't seen anything from government, you know, showing us the valuable, like our economy would collapse if we didn't have immigrant labour. You know, we absolutely need it. But what about a campaign to show, you know, what people do in their communities, what people are involved in the health service at all levels of Irish society? I mean, we only have to look at the Olympic Games where you see people of all colours, you know, representing their country.
But what I've saw the last couple of days is something I've never saw before. People, local Donegal people, with a picture of Miss Adelecki, her first name escapes me, sorry, just at the moment. And I'm just looking at a screenshot. I took a screenshot of a few of them here, effectively saying this person isn't Irish. Another immigrant flew into the country. We're being told they're Irish. No actual Irish people are winning medals. A joke of an Olympics. That's the kind of stuff I wouldn't have seen a couple of years ago, that you can actually be out in front saying that stuff.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think most right-thinking people are not thinking like that. It's just, unfortunately, these loud voices get amplified across social media, you know, and then people, you know, run with it. I do think that that kind of hate, you know, and I thought it was ironic, you know, we have politicians standing up in the Dáil talking about ending hate and ending this vile kind of racism that we're seeing some people, like our greatest athletes, subjected to. You know, the government has had a long time, you know, and politicians have had a long time to grasp this nettle, and they haven't. Mm-hmm. They've sort of let it run on and run on, and now it's like, you know, so much.
Yeah. I wonder, is it all about immigrants too?
Or Twitter?
Because see on X there, Cathy, say a politician like her own local Senator Eileen Flynn, if she posts anything on X that has anything to do with the travelling community, I'm like, oh boy, here we go. Mm-hmm. 200-300 comments of pure anti-traveller sentiment. You know, she's like a lightning rod for it. So I don't really know if we're, for the people that have a go at minorities, I don't think it matters sometimes what colour they are. It's just the fact that they are a minority. And just one question on that to you, Antoinette, if that's okay, before we move on.
Sure.
You know, how much of it is a noisy minority, or how much of it is the public sort of the public showing of what's rumbling under the surface in Irish society?
Yeah, well, I suppose a lot of the comments you see on X and the comments underneath posts, like the one you mentioned there, Greg, they're actually faceless, nameless trolls who hide behind a screen and a username or a false identity in order to be able to spread hate, vitriol, commentary that in an ordinary society they wouldn't be brave enough to put their profile and their identity up and state who they are, like the rest of us who have accounts on X and social media. And I post stuff frequently. I might comment on how police are treated or whatever, and I could get 300 or 400 comments underneath it. 90% of those would be faceless, nameless trolls and could be all levels of abuse or whatever. You could have your finger on the block button permanently on X these days with the amount of faceless, nameless trolls. But I mean, you have to, you can't disregard it because it's successfully spreading hate and misinformation. And that's why you go back to the social media platforms. There's a responsibility there. Government and other governments and the EU need to take it on as a collective. It's not good enough for everybody to say, oh, that's just a social media platform. Nothing can be done here. We have an EU commission. We have lots of places we can go with law. We can lots of countries that can unite on this, and something can be done and must be done.
Okay, and just briefly.
But it's the faceless, nameless trolls, yeah. Greg, in 90% of the things who are the brave people
behind.
Often they're
from outside the country as well and are funded and driven by other entities. I just want to do one more thing on this, and I'll go to you, Cathy, if that's all right, because I think sometimes in this country we're very proactive Very reactive rather than proactive. And there was a study coming out today about what concerns children. And teenagers are very clear in the concerns they have about having a house into the future and things like that there. I just wonder, has the Department of Education, either here or actually even in Britain, considered the month of discontent there has been and are preparing maybe for children coming into school? Maybe there's going to be, you know... Maybe kids are immune to this. I'm just worried that we're going to see more sort of maybe racially or minority driven problems in schools. Do you think that, am I being worrying too much, Cathy, or do you think the Department of Education should be a bit proactive in that and say, look, we may need to make sure if this happens after this summer that we nip it in the bud early?
Yeah, I think you're right, Greg. I think, you know, children... You know, we know that they all have their phones now, their smartphones, like from the age of 12, most of them have a phone in their hands. And, you know, we've seen that especially, young girls, young men, they're targeted by certain types, you know, to for their information. So they'll get so many young people are getting their so-called news from quite radical types that you know, you really wouldn't want your teenage children getting their information from. I think there's a big role here for the Department of Education to really look at digital literacy. How do children, you know, how do they find their content? How do they, you know, analyse? Well, that's not true. That is true. How do they look at what's coming at them? Because it is coming at them. And it's almost like an avalanche. So we it's almost like we are playing catch up here. You know, we're not, you know, these companies move so fast and they're so agile to target young people with information. And I think that there's definitely a role for education. The education piece is so important now because parents can't do it all. So I think that digital literacy and helping young people navigate this space to help them make informed decisions, to show them, well, maybe this person isn't the right person to be following. That is so important in this space that we're entering into.
But the problem is we have the way social media is set up is you can monetize hate. So the more your stuff spreads. So I think people need to realize they are actually the product here, because sometimes I think sometimes people think that, wow, this person gets me. No, this person, you're the product. They are targeting a message that you will interact with and share because they get paid by TikTok or they get paid by TikTok for you sharing this stuff that they're, you know what I mean? And these are people that are wide awake apparently, but they are a product of the person who's fashion. There was a lady just tried to become one of these people in America. It backfired on her, but she saw it as a revenue stream and think, right, I'm going to be a, you know, the white blonde face of sort of, you know, anti this and the other. And as I say, it backfired on her, but it was a career decision. It was clear it was a career decision.
Can bring you a lot of money. I think, you know, trying to, I suppose, educate a new generation of young adults to be discerning about what they're seeing and what they're viewing. And, you know, there was a chance under the new Commission Nemans, the commission that's going to monitor our media, there was a really good opportunity there to have, you know, the recommender algorithm. I don't think they went for that, because this is what, if you follow one person, then you're going to get, it's almost like you're in this little loop all the time. So we really need to look at what people are seeing and break those sort of chains, if you know what I mean.
Okay. Yeah. Very finally, one last thing to you, Declan, because we've spoke about this a few days in the past. People messaging in seem to think that this whole conversation is having concerns about pressure on services in the country, the amount of people that are being moved into certain areas. That's not what I'm having, that I'm questioning about. People will have genuine concerns that need to be addressed and voiced and heard. But I think we're mostly talking about the extremes here, where people's concerns are being weaponized, where people probably with no interest in these issues are actually just using it to go out into the street and throw petrol bombs. But again, it's funny, those who maybe have some concerns about immigration seem to think we're talking about them. I'm not talking about them, Declan. I don't think any of us are.
No, absolutely not. And I think, look, there's a real difference here, right? There are people who are concerned about services in their community, as you rightly say, Greg. And you'll find it very difficult to locate a community where the people living there, whether there's refugees and immigrants in that community or not, are concerned about the level of services that are available to them. We are under-resourced in every sense of the word, whether it's health services, whether it's policing, whether it's education, whether it's youth services. And that has been long the case. And that is a failing of government. And what people need to do is to channel all of that and to look at their electoral choices when that comes around and vote for parties and individuals that they believe are going to rectify that. Because we have had the same parties in government for a century. And we have had an under-resourcing of communities, whether rural or urban, the length and breadth of the country. And that is not the fault of refugees or immigrants. And before we had a ramping up of migration into the country where since the Ukraine war in February 2022, these problems were all in situ. We've had a housing disaster for well over 10, 15 years at this stage. And that seems to be one of the real touchstone issues around this.
And we also have a situation. I was speaking to two parents yesterday whose children have to walk up a very dangerous road to get to the school bus. It's about half a kilometre, OK? And they know, and I know, and everyone knows, that there are children, maybe Ukrainian children or IPAS students, but particularly Ukrainians, where a bus will drive a mile up a road specifically to pick up two kids and take them and drop them off at the school. That is happening. Now, those parents aren't far right in saying that it seems a little unfair. They don't want that service to stop, but they feel it's unfair that one set of children get one very tailored specific service and their children are being asked to walk up and down a half kilometre road in the depths of winter and the parents don't have a car. That's not anti-immigration or anything like that. That's people who are saying this is unfair. And while those unfair situations persist, there are some will get quite angry about that and might get motivated by certain individuals out there. So I think that's where you're talking about that the government needs to address.
That's unfortunately the reality. And, you know, one of the big things, I suppose, is around accommodation and housing. And I have said before to you, Greg, that so long as it remains more lucrative for property owners and landlords to house refugees and immigrants as opposed to people on housing waiting lists and council waiting lists, we're always going to have these inequalities and inequities, and they should not be there. And that's a failing of government policy. Okay. But people, when they're protesting and people, when they're expressing their dissatisfaction, have to punch up and not punch down. We also need to reacquaint ourselves with the reasons why people are coming here seeking safe haven. That's a huge thing that we were starting to forget that we are missing. Unless something is in the 24-hour news cycle, we tend to forget. Palestine is to the fore, Ukraine is no longer. But the reality is that there are swathes of Ukraine that no longer exist. You know, there are people living in Milford, for example, whose cities don't exist anymore. Yeah. You know, when we've forgotten those kind of central tenets of why people are here.
Okay.
But those inequalities that you talk about, Greg, they have to be addressed. Yeah. I agree 100%.
And have to be talked about. And that's why I said it specifically, because sometimes you have to say, this is the conversations that are happening in houses. Antoinette, do you want a final word on that, or should I take a break and we can move on?
It's up to you, Greg.
I'd just be interested in a final word for you on this.
Well, I think that the example that you've given there about the school kids, you know, that's where grievances start at a very local level. Mm-hmm. And that's where inequality is perceived at a very local level. And that's what people talk about in the local shop and the local pub.
Yes.
And what you need to do then is address those inequalities at that very level so that they don't spread and grow and become more and more enlarged. Because the very minute people have a grievance about something or a bias towards it, they then set out to find further biases or further inequalities, therefore making the problem mushroom and grow and grow. So if there is an inequality like that, that's down to communication again at a very local level. Say, look, there's a little inequality here. We need to address it. All things need to be equal. We don't live in a perfect world, Greg. We all know that. But if it can start and be solved locally, then it doesn't mushroom and grow.
The caller says, hi, Greg. Can your guests give us some examples of the misinformation and disinformation they're talking about? Well, I can't speak on behalf of the guests, but let's say, for instance, in Britain, that awful situation where three young girls lost their lives. Leaders of the far right, and I'm not grouping people with concerns in that, stated that it was a migrant that came off a boat that day, effectively, and had caused it. In this country, let's just see what triggered the Dublin riots, for an example, was were claims that a girl that hadn't died was dead, and that her death was being covered up by the state and the hospital with a view to playing the public or what have you. Now, thankfully, she's not dead and had a visit home, which was quite important this week, or her family. Other information that was put out there recently was that the person that was responsible for it has been taken away and never charged in court, where he was charged just before Christmas, a 50-year-old charged with attempted murder. Those are things that sparked the riots in Britain and Belfast and also in Dublin. So I'm not speaking on behalf of the guests, I know you put that question to them, but there's two examples of misinformation and disinformation, and I could name the people that were spreading it in this country, centred around Dublin, that effectively triggered the Dublin riots. So that would be an example. Not people having concerns about certain issues and having worries and wanting to tease it out, I think is what we're trying to get at. But I understand that listeners seem to conflate maybe their concerns they have with the types of events and people that we're talking of. And I think they are somewhat different, Antoinette.
Yeah, no, we've seen loads of examples even, Greg, of where, you know, it's asserted that a certain hotel or building is going to be used as an iPast accommodation centre, inciting fear and concerning communities and with people for it to turn out that, in fact, it's not going to be used for that purpose at all. So they're very simple examples. We see every day banners saying Coolock says no, a wide sweeping statement. Some people in Coolock don't say no. They say we want to be communicated with to find out what's actually going to happen here. So misinformation and disinformation is across a broad spectrum, including saying that suspects in crimes are asylum seekers, foreign nationals, migrants, when in fact they may not be. So there's lots of examples, examples.
And Tommy Robinson yesterday, and his followers yesterday posting videos, in one instance from outside Britain, in another from 3 or 4 years ago, saying that there's tier 2 policing. This is happening in Solihull today or whatever it might be. And it is completely provable that it's not the case. But these videos have 5 or 6 million. That's misinformation. That's disinformation.
Can I jump in there, Greg?
Of course, Cathy, whenever.
I don't know. I've lost count of the number of times I've heard about unvetted males coming into this country. And we don't, you know, I've heard this thrown out, and it seeps into the public consciousness that somehow men who come into this country that are unaccompanied by family or woman or anything else are somehow dangerous and to be distrusted. And, you know, they've been linked with an increase in sexual violence and sexual assault. There's absolutely no proof of this.
But if you live in a small community where you can't get access to a GP, and there's very little happening, and a bus lands in with 20 people that you weren't consulted about or talked about in advance, that will play to you, because that will say, well, I am now concerned because this has happened. What I'm trying to get at is there can be genuine concerns within the community, but then you get this, you know, unvetted males, whatever, and it does amplify those genuine concerns.
That's different, I suppose, like, absolutely, the messaging is playing into people's maybe insecurities or, you know, anger that's already there about a lack of services. But it doesn't take away from the fact that a lot of this is misinformation. I mean, there are countless examples. The unvetted males is the biggest example and the most used trope around immigration and asylum seekers. That's definitely the biggest one. Also, as Cathy touched on, it was one that came up actually during the elections on Highland Radio. Someone was asserting that rape had increased 1,000%. Like, stuff like this, where it's just enough nonsense out.
But in fairness, and this is where the role of media, that was countered immediately.
It was, Greg, absolutely. But that's the sort of stuff that's circulating online that one of your listeners has asked, you know, can you give examples of...
Yeah, no, I get you. I'll take your point. Okay.
Yeah.
A couple of things too. I mean, this may not spend too much time on it, but we're just weeks away from the start of another school year. The uniform debate has raised its head again. I think sometimes the media dig into this one because it's that time of the year, but it is actually quite a serious issue, because a recent survey shows that primary school parents are going to spend €119 on uniforms this year, secondary school parents €211. Now, that seems a bit conservative to me, because there's some schools want PE gear and other stuff in on top of that. on. 90%, 9 out of 10 secondary school parents are concerned about meeting the costs of uniforms. But Cathy, I'll start with this one on you. Should school uniforms be scrapped? Because if they're scrapped, then it's about what kind of runners you're wearing. Are you wearing the Adidas pants or whatever it might be? So I'm interested in hearing the arguments for or against, whichever way you stand, Cathy.
Yeah. I mean, I'd be a really big, you know, believer in the uniform for the sense of just, you know, literally uniformity, that everyone is the same. Because I think that, you know, we're in the middle of a cost of living crisis. Not everybody's impacted to the same extent. Some people cannot afford, you know, the latest runners. Runners for kids are so expensive. Like, I have two boys and they're complaining about, you know, the blandness of their school uniform, the green jumper and the black trousers, and the runners have to be black. They have to wear black jackets with no logo on them. They can be hard to find. But, you know, the logo thing is so big in a teenager's world that when you take away all these, you know, this, I suppose, freedom, and kids love to express themselves. There's other ways they can express their individuality. I'm all on for that. But I do think that a uniform gives a level playing field, because if we didn't have one, this culture of the haves and the have-nots and people who can, you know, afford all the latest trappings of gear and stuff, that would go mad altogether. Mm-hmm. So I'm firmly that everybody goes in, everybody's wearing the same jumper with the crest and the shoes, and yes, it's expensive, but I can't even imagine what it would be like trying to kit out, especially teenagers, for secondary school if you didn't have a uniform, Greg.
Yeah, Antoinette?
I suppose my own track record, if I look back on the wearing of uniform in accordance with the rules, mightn't be an A+, Greg, so we shouldn't delve too deeply into that, I'd suggest. But look, I suppose pros and cons. Look, there's a huge financial cost to a uniform, and I think particularly a uniform that bears a college or a crest of a school. That's where the problem actually lies. If you had generic jumpers and stuff without the crest, because it's when you get into the blazer with the crest and the jumper with the crest, that's where the money starts to rack up. So I think that's the aspect that's the real disadvantage. Of course, it does limit your self-expression. You're one of the gang and crowd. Look, I suppose the plus side of it then, Greg, is this is the first kind of time that you have to obey the rules and to be part of a discipline in a school, and the school requires you to dress like this and act like this and present your appearance like this. And, you know, I mean, it's the normal thing to do is to rebel against the rules and the discipline. But it does form that thing about a set of rules in an environment that everybody has to adhere to. The biggest thing is it does eliminate the pressure of fashion trends, which is impossible to keep up with, and an endless pit. And I can tell you, dressing in your everyday out of uniform clothes, it does put stress on youngsters, you know, and they have to think about what they're going to wear and their image and how they look and how they compare to others. So I think it eliminates all that. I think we need to look at this cresting of schools using specific things, and that's
and
where
specific
maybe
shops as well. And I'm conscious, I don't want to do anything that's negative towards any local businesses, but some schools do drive you to a specific outlet, so you don't have any choice. And I would say for some parents and even students, you know, they'd have these initiatives where, you know, a couple of times a year you pay €2 and you can wear whatever you like to school. I'd say that's a nightmare for some, let alone having to do that every day. And Declan, the interesting thing in that survey that I didn't mention is that parents are, for the most part, in favour of uniforms if they're more affordable.
Yeah, Lucas, I mean, I was talking to a friend of mine this week, and her child is going to a secondary school, and the uniform cost was €350. And I think uniforms are a great idea. I do think they level the playing field in theory. I think that what Antoinette said there about crested jumpers is a huge, huge issue that, you know, I think could easily be resolved, because primary school uniforms are so, so much cheaper for that reason. But secondary schools, in my opinion, have lost the run of themselves, because now it is not only a uniform, it is also a uniform coat that is branded with a school crest, and it is uniform PE gear that is branded with school branding or school crest. And that is what is driving up the costs exponentially. Also, just like a note on the back to school clothing and footwear allowance, cost of living measures have been brought in over the past few years by governments, which are very welcome to people. One of the key things that they could do to help people who are really struggling at this difficult time of year, people with children, is they could broaden the eligibility criteria for the back to school clothing and footwear allowance, because it is a really helpful payment for families who are entitled to it. But there's so many people who are within the income bands, as in they don't earn over what's allowable, but they don't qualify because they're not on a qualifying social welfare payment. And that to me is ludicrous. If someone on a qualifying social welfare payment is under the band but and is entitled to it, then someone who isn't on a qualifying social welfare payment but is under the band should also be entitled to it. It would just be a really sensible cost of living practice that the government could bring in.
All right, Declan, always a pleasure. Thank you very much indeed. I really appreciate your time. That's Councillor Declan Meehan there. We also had the company of Antoinette Cunningham. Always a pleasure. Thank you so much, Antoinette. Have a lovely weekend. Take care of yourself. And our last guest today was Cathy Donaghy, Inishowen-based journalist and author. Cathy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Greg.
Bye-bye. Have a lovely weekend. Bye-bye. Right, thank you to so many of you texting and calling in. We're going to be getting to some of those comments, as many as possible, over the course of the morning. But first, let's take a break. Just to remind you that coming up later on in the programme, we will be launching a call for you to enter our... I don't actually have any documentation on this. I have to do it off the top of my head, but it's our Irish Music Month. We are going to be selecting a local act who will become our local hero. They'll win a prize, which I'll outline for you a little later on, but also then go on to represent this county, this region, Highland Radio, in a major national competition. The prize being a lot of money towards gear and production and airplay and all that type of stuff. And it... I'll talk more about this later on, but it has been and can be a platform to really, really successful careers. So that's coming up after 11. So anyone around you, if it's you or around you or in your house that is musical and that wants to enter that competition, listen in about 11:30. We'll have all the deets. But now we take a break for the news and obituary notices.